The following is a presentation of Open for Business, InterVarsity Christian Fellowship's conference for business students and business professionals at the Urbana 06 Missions Convention, held in St. Louis, December 2006. For more information, please visit ofb.intervarsity.org. The tone you will hear in the middle of this segment marks a brief gap in recording. We apologize for the few seconds of lost audio.
The next speaker that we'll hear from is Ram Gidamal, and he's here from the UK, and legend has it that he gave up a vacation in a tropical paradise with his family to be here, and his entire family is actually here with him. He has a fan club, his wife, his children, their spouses are all here, and Ram accepted almost on the spot. He was really excited to be here, and John and several of the organizers said he got the vision right away. He is an entrepreneur, and he was a former UK group executive of the Inlax Group, which is a multinational company that operates in 15 countries with 7,000 employees. He led the newly formed political party, the Christian People Alliance, and has run for mayor of London twice, in 2000 and 2004, both times polling almost 100,000 votes. And one of my favorite facts about Ram was that he himself was a refugee. He arrived in London with nothing from East Africa in 1967, and that has given him a heart for refugees. And he is the chairman of the Employability Forum, which helps refugees find jobs. And he's also the founder, trustee, and chairman of the Christmas Cracker Charity, which has given thousands of young people entrepreneurial experience and raised over £5 million for work in developing countries. So please welcome Ram.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everybody. What a joy and privilege it is for me and my family to be here at Urbana with you all. And when Jimmy Quash called me and John Tyrrell and all the folk at Urbana, you're right, the vision, when they said what they were planning, I was so excited. I said, this is a much-needed initiative. Not enough of it is taking place across the globe, and it is fantastic that here in Urbana you have a dedicated track open for business, something that chimes with my heart. And you know, as Father Ben was speaking and describing Smoky Mountain, I just want to take you to an experience I had as a businessman running this business, three of us running a business of 7,000 people in 15 countries, turning over $200 million. And I was in charge of one of the units directly, 600 people in Scotland, and we were doing smoked salmon, crab, scampi, scallops, and they said, go to India and buy some more seafoods. So I went. And when I went, on the last day of a 10-day trip, I was taken to the slums of Bombay, the largest slum in Asia, Dharavi. I'd never been to a slum before. Yes, I was a refugee from East Africa and Britain, but this, going into the slums, was just something different. I went there and I saw a group of, there was like young girls behind cages. And it wouldn't take a genius to work out what was going to happen to those young girls who'd only just hit puberty. I can't even describe what I saw. It was so heartbreaking. I saw a five-year-old boy, and I have a five-year-old in Scotland at that time. And I said, "Where is he going to stay?" And they showed me this water pipe, and they said, "You see that water pipe? That's where he's going to stay." I said, "But what's wrong with those cardboards that are on the side pavings?" They said, "Oh, the slum lord will not allow this. He can't afford to pay the slum lord." friends, that, you know, it just broke me. I couldn't believe that I was on the same planet as what was going on here. Yes, I was an elder at the church in Switzerland where we were living. Yes, I was doing my tithes. Yes, all church going, all that. This was a real world. And as I researched this, as I then went on from that plane journey, you know, I got onto that plane, first class, Air France, caviar, champagne. I couldn't touch it. I was deep down sick. And I came back, spoke to my wife, Salita. I said, we got to do something. This cannot be right. When you can't spend the interest you're earning, and our needs are not that much. You know, we don't want a yacht or a plane or anything like that. We were saying, what are we doing? Why do we do what we do? You know, that journey, that point I've described you, is a point in a journey in my life which actually I can take you a rewind. If I play the rewind button. See, my family were twice migrants. We were first in South Asia. It was British India. And when it was partitioned in 1947, we lost everything. Palace, everything. The whole lot. They jumped on a ship and got to East Africa, where I was born, in 1950. We were there in East Africa. 20 years later, 17 years from me, but 47 to 67, we were deported. Overnight, everything we'd made. I still remember the house. 15 bedrooms, cars, drivers, the whole lot. Everything gone, taken away in an instant. And we landed in Shepherd's Bush in London. And we started life in a corner shop. I don't know what you call a corner shop in America, but I think it's a mom and pop store, that kind of thing. You sell cigarettes, tobacco, newspapers, all that, chocolates. It was a humiliating experience for my uncle. My father had died after the first partition of India in tragic circumstances. My uncle who brought me up, he couldn't cope. He died within weeks of arriving in London. 15 of us, 4 bedrooms, began life in the West. But I'd made a commitment to my uncle. I said, I'm going to go to university. All the others at 12 or 13, they went into business. You know, I come from the Sindhi community. Now, Sindhis, there are about 14 million in the planet, on this planet. And from the Sindhi community of 14 million, there's about a few thousand, just a few thousand believers. In 67, I was told there was you could count them in your on either hand. All of the Sindhis went to business. You know, business as mission appeals to me. The DNA is, you know, you have the DNA of business. We just born with it, you know. I still remember my youngest brother at school. You know what? You get sweets to take to school. Guess what he did to the sweets? Instead of giving them away, he sold them. And everyone in the family is in business. But I'd made a commitment to my uncle. You know, they said, you're a bright kid. You got O-levels, which is like at 16 you get qualifications. They said, I said to my uncle before he died, I will go to university. And I kept my word. And I went to university. And it was at university that I met with Jesus. You see, I come from a Hindu family. My uncle brought me up in the Sikh faith. I was sent to a school which was a Muslim school. It was the best school in the local area. So now at this point I've got 3 insurance policies, okay? I'm now at Imperial College in London. And I praise and thank God for the work of organizations like UCCF, InterVarsity, International Students Work. You know, I was there absolutely miserable, away from my family for the first time in my life. There I was sitting, thinking, what am I doing here? And it was there that in a pub I met with Christ. And it was through Campus Crusade. And yes, the 4 spiritual laws do work. I accepted Christ as my Savior and I gave Him my life. Thank you. And I have never, ever looked back since then. I met my wife, Sunita. We got married. I got a job in the city of London. Within weeks, within months, I discovered glass doors and glass ceilings. I hadn't been to the right school and the right university. And I said, nah, not for me. And her uncle was starting a commodity business. And he asked if I would join him. I said, yes, I'm a risk taker. Business appeals to me. And within, that was in 1979. By 1987, I was now traveling to Bombay for this trip. And I was right at the top of this company. And it was just an amazing experience of looking after and being in charge of a business of 7,000 people, turning over these hundreds of millions of dollars. It was exciting. It was exciting. That Bombay slum visit broke my heart. I said, this cannot be the same planet I'm living on. And it was at that point that I said, with my wife, we said, we got to think about this. Now, one of the fascinating things I'm finding at Urbana, and I just love what's going on with this thing of calling, because I was struggling with this word calling. People used to say to me, I got a call. And I'd say, you know, who phoned you? And that kind of thing. What's calling? What do you mean by calling? What? And nobody could explain it to me. Or maybe they did and I was blocking. I couldn't understand what calling meant. Friends, I can tell you, when I visited the slum in Bombay and I came back to my desk, Group Chief Executive United Kingdom for the INLAX group, I couldn't sit on that desk for more than half an hour without my mind going to the slums. Without my mind thinking of those girls behind those cages. Without my mind thinking about that five-year-old boy saying, what are you going to do about this, Ram? It was God. I mean, it was just incredible. It just kept coming to me. It kept coming to me. And I couldn't sit. And in the end, even though I had scheduled to see my chairman in August, this was in April I visited. In May I was having a struggle. In June, I just couldn't wait. I said to my chairman, I want to talk to you. And that's where the whole thing began. And I chatted with my wife. And then, you know, I had to test it. Is it just me being emotionally hyped up? Or is this God calling? So I had listened to, I had some brilliant preachers preaching. And because my wife and I moved so much with the business, we were in touch with three pastors simultaneously. The one in Geneva, the one in London, and the one in Scotland where we were living for the seafoods business. So I called each one of them. So I had three pastors to check with. Three sets of elders. I had a whole group of people to check with. And one of the sermons I heard gave this very visual, clear message. An analogy from sailing. They said, if the lighthouse, the rudder of the ship, okay, and the compass, if the three align, you know you're going on track to the direction you want to get to. And this pastor said, the word of God, prayer, and the counsel and advice of good friends. If those three begin to coincide, I think you'll find you're moving in the right direction. And I began to find it. The pastors, the friends, the prayer. And it came to a point where both Sunita and me said, we've got peace of mind about this. We really believe God is calling. He wants us to do something. You know, one soundbite I want to share with you, the preacher shared, has never left my mind. Because the thought was, well, maybe I'll stay one more year, make that extra bit, just be that much more secure to be able to give, to do. And the message that kept coming back is, enough is always a little more. So when do you stop? And that challenged me. I said, no, stop. Let's see what we can do. And what can I do now to respond to what I had seen? You see, my attitude to business was very simple. As I said, I come from a Sindhi community. I still remember one of the most exciting deals I did. This involved frozen chicken from the United States to Nigeria. $7 million of frozen chicken within 3 weeks became worth $21 million. Now, I had no hesitation before about doing this. But now I thought with my conscience, is it right? You're raping an economy in a developing country. You're squeezing money out where there is need. Is it right? What is fair business? What is ethical business? I really was challenged. That Bombay visit blew my mind. Smoky Mountain blew my mind. I've seen that video, Pastor, Father. It really is worth seeing those sights. And going there, when you describe the smells, you know, I had read about poverty and all, but when you go into the slums, the smells will get you. That's the real impact. My attitude was like that. You know, you then start researching. And 1.2 billion people live on less than $2 a day. Here's another stat from Europe. The average European cow gets a subsidy of £1.20 a day. More than is earned by half the people in the developing world. That's sobering, isn't it? So what had happened is that slum I visited in Bombay, somebody else had also been sent there by a mutual friend, Dr. Raju Abraham. And his name is Steve Chalk, Reverend Steve Chalk, a Baptist youth minister. So he'd been there, I'd been there, and both of us came back crying, all right? We were both just depressed. And this Dr. Raju Abraham, a consultant neurophysiologist in one of the big hospitals, top hospitals in London, he brought us together. I still remember the scene, sitting in my boardroom, and there is this Baptist youth pastor. And he comes with these big, you know, these boots that are sort of studded on the side, and he comes walking in, you know. Roy, you know, we're going to talk, mate. You know, and he comes and he sits. And I'm thinking, help. And I said, where's your business plan? And he looks at me, business plan? Look. And then we interacted. I calmed down. I sort of said, look, listen, well, this guy's got ideas. Work together. And what happened was most exciting. We set up a project called Christmas Cracker, which was mentioned in the introduction. And a Christmas cracker, for those of you who don't know in the United States, basically it's made out of paper. It's a sort of tube with which papers at either end, and you pull this, it pops, and out comes a gift, okay? And it's Christmas tradition in Britain, and everyone has it at the dinner table, and you sort of put your hands like this, you pull, and you out of the cracker comes a gift. So this was Christmas cracker. And Steve Chalk had run one restaurant, and this restaurant just appealed to me. It was called Eat Less, Pay More. All right? And guess what? It worked. He said, one restaurant ran, we ran, raised £5,000, and we were able to fund 8 wells in India. So my mind, business, business as mission. This could give a taster for mission to young people. Because, you know, I was 37 when I went to the slums, and I had no appreciation about the less well-off on this planet. I had no appreciation. I was ashamed of myself. My school curriculum didn't teach me about slums and poverty and all the issues. I said, young people need to be made aware of it. So we said, how can we combine our business skills and have a project that will make these people potential entrepreneurs and draw out from these people skills and gifts that they have but which they may be afraid to try out? So we did it. Eat less, pay more. I said to Steve, I said, look, if McDonald's can do a franchise, why don't we do a franchise? We franchised it. We put out franchises all over the country through magazines and what have you. 100 groups registered. Our target was 200. £500,000 was raised in 1 month before Christmas. High spend, high guilt time of the year. We just got it, man. I tell you, they just came in and they just gave. And I said, hey. But more important than the money was young people running businesses. They ran it. They appointed advertising agents. They appointed marketing people. They opened bank accounts. Some of them had never signed a check in their life. I'm talking in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, when credit cards were still not as prevalent as they are today. You almost get one when you're born, don't you? You know what I mean. But this was at that time. And this is what then happened. And the results were just absolutely stunning. A bank picked it up. A major bank in Europe, in fact, one of the top global banks, heard about this project. And to my absolute delight, joy, and I was very humbled, I got a call from their main board in Switzerland. Would you come and tell our board what the critical success factors were for that business that you did with the young people? And, you know, they paid a pretty nice fee. It was a 5-figure fee. I thought, wow, this is great. You know, you're getting paid to share about something that you did. And, you know, this is fun. And, you know, that's what went to the charity. Well, today, at no expense, extra expense to you, I'm going to share with you those seven, the seven principles that they may have paid a fortune for. But here you are, folks. But you know, the money of the cracker raised, you got to put against the statistics, the global statistics. This is one I picked up from a website, globalenvision.org. And the subject on this article was, quote, rising tide that will not float all boats. Okay? While between 1980 and 2002, the rich countries grew on average by almost 2% per capita annually, the poorest 40 countries in the world had a combined growth rate of zero. Zilch. For large swathes of Africa, where about 200 million people live, the income level today is less than it was during the U.S. presidency of John F. Kennedy. That's the statistic we're dealing with. In Zimbabwe, between 1995 and 2003, life expectancy declined by 11 years to reach only 39 years. Of course, there's no limit to global needs, but there is, I can tell you, no limit to the global opportunity to do something about these issues. These lessons that I learned, let me just share with you these elements. The first one was simplicity, S for simplicity. You know, we use the simple idea. Pithy sound bites, eat less, pay more. The following year, we ran a radio stations, 100 radio stations across the country. Tune in, pay out. And logos and slogans like justice, not just us. And it appealed to communities. You know, yeah, we agree with that. You know, a simple basic principle that there must be some form of gain or added value is at the heart of business. At its rawest state, business involves buying at a lower price, selling at a higher price or a higher perceived value. You know, there's nothing wrong with that basic principle. Jesus' parable of the talents amply demonstrates this. When we were at a holiday in Florida last week, and I was just chatting with my son Ravi about this point, you know, he sort of came back with this comment, and I'll quote him, quote, "I agree. And if you want to make this point even more strongly at Urbana, Dad, you should ask what Jesus said happened to the one talent that was taken away from the guy who produced nothing. It went to the one with 10, not the one with 5. Could this mean Jesus was a capitalist?" I said, gosh, there's a loaded point. I said, whoa, hold it, son. I've seen Jesus as a left-wing socialist now. Let's have a debate here. But, you know, we have different perspectives, don't we, of what's going on. But I need to let you know my son's a banker. So... All right. But you know, with business as mission, it is what you do with the gain and the added value that is crucial. And of course, how you achieve that gain. The point to stress here is simplicity. The simpler the idea, the easier it will be to implement and deliver. Let me share with you something I read in Fortune magazine on the flight from London. And I'll just read you this idea. There are ideas galore. The opportunities are immense. And I just wish I had the time and energy to follow this idea, but I want one of you to do this, and maybe more of you. It was about a thing called a life straw. Life straw. I shared with you that 1.2 billion people do not have access to clean drinking water. Now, somebody has seen this market for 1.2 billion people. And they're in Switzerland, and they've invented a portable filter which allows you to drink from almost any source, however polluted, through a simple plastic tube filled with carbon and other filters that remove deadly particles and 99% of bacteria like Salmonella. I just saw it and I said, boy, this is so simple. And there's a picture. I couldn't bring it with me or scan it in time for this conference, but it looks like a straw, and this guy is drinking from water that he's clearly taken from the river, and he's drinking confidently. And I'm thinking, wow, who's got the agency? Who's got the distribution rights? Let's get them. Let's use them. $3 is the price that they're selling that for. At the moment, only charitable organizations are taking it, but the guy behind it, and it's in the last issue of Fortune if you want to look it up, he's saying, I'm looking for distributors and those who are prepared to take it. I would say there's an opportunity here to take the rights in for certain areas, to manufacture in local communities, and to use this straw for the good of mankind. And you and I as believers should be there first, selling and taking this life straw there to give life and life eternal as a message that goes with all that we do. C, the second principle, creativity. Going beyond our comfort zone, following Christ's example. You know, these youth groups, they were just wonderful, the young people who ran Cracker. They sought publicity because they knew that media attention equaled newspaper footage, equaled television time, equaled more free advertising and marketing. Now, there is a book I've been very influenced by, which I'm just reading at the moment. In fact, it's just out last year. It's by Stuart Hart, Professor Stuart Hart. The book is called Capitalism at the Crossroads, The Unlimited Business Opportunities in Solving the World's Most Difficult Problems. And in this book, Professor Hart uses terms like creative destruction, radical transactiveness. The terms are self-explanatory when you think about them. Disequilibrium. You know, what he's saying is look, we need to shake things up. We need to get out of the comfort zone. We need to think out of the box. We need to do things radically differently if we are really going to make a big impact in terms of leveraging or leveraging. I'm not quite sure which side of the pond pronounces the word which way, but when I use leveraging, I get corrected to leveraging and vice versa. But you know what I mean? Multiplying the impact of what you do. And he makes a very interesting point. In fact, last night at one of the seminars that I went to, Daniel Bird seminar, he was talking about innovation. And that just chimes with me because this thought about the life straw is about innovation. What Hart says is the base of the pyramid, there is a term called base of the pyramid, B-O-T-P. That is where a lot of innovation and creativity is going to be happening. Because if you can crack a problem at that level, you cracked it. And it's being proven. That salt powder that you all are developing in Manila, Father Ben, you know, in this book that I'm reading, there is an example of a company in India that decided to take on one of the world's largest multinationals, Unilever. This company said, right, we'll go to the villages, we'll go into the slums, and we are going to produce detergents, soap, and products that these folk in the villages are going to be able to afford, have access to, and will meet all the quality standards. And they went about it differently. You know what? They started making so much inroads into the market that Unilever in India, it's called Hindustan Lever Limited, HHL, was absolutely moved. They ignored it. They said, oh, these guys will never achieve anything. Forget them. They were moved to take action very quickly because their very foundations were being shaken now. They put in a whole team to look at this, and they started competing. They changed their business model. They changed their business practices. And an area of the community that they ignored, that they thought was not worthwhile, that they thought was just, and in fact, the word that Hart uses in his book is undeserving. How dare they use that term? And yet, that company, that small company in India, took them on, and today they're competing for market share. And the latest statistic I saw on a marketing website, Info Online in India, says Unilever 40%, this little company 40%. They took them on. My point is innovation, a different way of doing things. You're going to break the system. The way that Father Ben is tackling it in Manila, the way that different people at the base of the pyramid are beginning to tackle these issues is bringing out creativity of an untold dimension and proportion to tackle the problems and to take advantage of the global opportunities so that we can meet global needs. R for relational working. These restaurants, radio stations, newspapers, they all worked on relationships at local communities. And, you know, the lessons learned in working across all kinds of divides enabled these people, young people, to look beyond their communities. Relationships were then developed and built with the recipients of the funds. Now, it may have been seen as a charity project, voluntary fundraising, a business as a mission taster. But look at what this starts doing. Those young people wanted to get in touch with the projects in India in the first instance. And I want to give you an example of a BAM that developed. A business's mission project that developed through such relational working. There was a project in India called Jacob's Well. Now, Jacob's Well was a refuge for prostitutes who were running away from pimps and from the hold of people who were trying to enslave them. Now, of course, when Christmas Cracker sent money out there, more young girls came out of prostitution and ran to Jacob's Well. So guess what happens? Somebody's money-making has now been disrupted. So they start attacking, and they start closing doors, and they start doing things that make it very difficult for these young girls to get away. So the girls in London, young girls in London, who ran the project, picked this news up. So they weren't going to be beat. You know what they did? They said, right, we're going to book a flight to Bombay. We're going to take sewing machines with us. We're going to buy material. We're going to help them design clothes, design handbags, design goods that we know for a fact that can sell in London. And we're going to set up a whole chain here, a supply chain, a purchase chain, a manufacturing base, and we are going to get these girls into business. It worked. Jacob's well is still surviving. People said, oh, it's a charitable thing, it'll go. It's sustainable. It's going. And I tell you, it was an amazing, it was a gratifying experience just to see business as mission take off in the way it's done. And as I've walked across the conference talking to people, I picked up an example that's happening in the Philippines and another one in Cebu Island in the Philippines where they're making chairs and furniture. And it's great to see that it is possible to break the system and do something to make a difference. The next point, ambitious goals. You know, when we started Cracker, I said, oh, we're going to raise £1 million, 200 groups, £5,000 each, £1 million. So a major radio station, Radio 4 is a big station in the United Kingdom. The Prime Minister, the Cabinet, they all listen to it. I get a call from them. We hear you've got some big thing going, Mr. Gidumal. I said, yes. They said, come on. This is a brand new idea. Who are you kidding? You're going to raise £1 million in your first year? Are you trying to deceive? Is this right? I said, look. It's a target, number one. And if you aim for £1 million and hit half of it, that's at least £500,000. It's better than aiming for nothing and hitting 100% of nothing. The journalist thought, he said, okay, you got a point. We raised £500,000. We had an ambitious goal. Everybody got excited. Everybody got revved up. They went for it. You know, we've got to think big if we are going to tackle the global needs and opportunities. We've got to think big. You remember in the Bible, Joshua and Caleb, in Numbers 13 and 14, when Moses sent them and said, go on this exploratory trip, see what the promised land looks like. And then they came back with their report. Exciting report. Big figs, big grapes, big fruit. But hey, there's big people, there's giants there, they're scared. What a pity. They saw the giants, they ran scared, and for 40 more years, they were in the wilderness. Friends, we must not be afraid when we know the God we've got with us. We must not be afraid. We've got to take the challenge on. And ambitious goals, nothing wrong with it. Teamworking. You know, as I've spoken to different people, I'm sort of asking, because this is my first time in Urbana and the first time speaking in the United States, I wanted to get a feel for the conference and say, look, what are people's expectations? What was interesting is each individual I spoke to was giving me an individual response, very valid, very realistic, but I said, how come nobody is telling me that what we want to do is meet other like-minded people so that we can work together? You know, my experience of responding to this situation has been working with, you know, there was Dr. Raju Abraham, there was Steve Chalk, there were other people I can mention. Every project I've undertaken has always been with a group, with a team. Sharing it. You know, our inspiration, and this is a very important point I really want to stress, our inspiration has been the Clapham sect. I want to ask here, how many of you in this room have heard of the Clapham sect? Great. Okay. Look at those hands that are up, by the way. If you haven't heard of them, look at the hands that are up. Just look at the hands that are up. I would urge you to go and look out for those folk and talk to them about the Clapham sect. The Clapham sect was a group of 7 influential evangelicals in the United Kingdom in the 17th and 18th century. They met regularly. They prayed regularly together. And they were seeking to challenge and tackle the biggest issues of their time in the 17th and 18th century. One of the biggest issues of that time was slavery. And one of the members of the Clapham sect was William Wilberforce. And William Wilberforce got his inspiration and help and support from a like-minded group of individuals who worked with him, prayed with him. And if you want to get the paper that I was reading and referring to that synthesizes the idea of this small group, it's on the website www.cslewisinstitute.org. It is well worth it. I'll just get you one quote from that paper. Their strengths and the reason for their success, a common commitment to Jesus Christ and to each other, a clear calling and a faith that was integral to all of life, family, career, friendship and more. I mean, that's only one quote from a very short article. Well worth the read. Another critical success factor for Cracker? It was unashamedly Christian in its foundation. There was no question about this. These were young people who belonged to churches. These were local church communities that were responding. And I want to read Romans 12:1-2 at this point. Therefore, I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. This is your spiritual act of worship. Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, His good, pleasing and perfect will. This, my friends, is business as worship. Business as worship. Doing business in a way that is different, that expresses your worship to God, because you are working with transparency, with accountability, with consistency. These are the hallmarks of Christians working in business as mission. You know, good governance and Christian witness are so important. Behaving with integrity and with Bible-based values. The risks of greed, corruption, bribery are very high. Temptation comes in so many different and subtle guises. A colleague of mine in India has a hospital unit, a medical unit and other stuff running on a site. It was established by missionaries from a long while ago. No one ever corrected the paperwork. There was no company secretary. So the title deeds are in a mess. But it's perfectly legit. It's valid. It's legal. There's nothing wrong. So he goes to the official. He says, could you please now correct the title deeds to demonstrate who the current trustees and owners are? How much? I want something to do this. He said, hey, but this is my right. I don't want to pay you a bribe. That's, you know, it's against my faith. I want this done. The guy said, no, come back. It won't be done. He then went to a lawyer. And the lawyer smiled. He said, look, I can do it. But I'll charge you a fee, and the fee will be more than what you think it will be, because I have to make payments. What do you do? Now, I want to commend you this dilemma, because there's a magazine that all of you got in your pack when you registered for the BAM track, Ethics. And on the back page of Ethics, this dilemma I read, and I thought it was in my talk, it was in the back of the magazine, and I said, what would you do as believers now? It is a tough, tough call. You know, the Bible is so right in 1 Peter 5:8 when we read, be self-controlled and alert. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, looking for someone to devour. You know, I could fill an entire series of lectures on this big issue of ethics in the workplace. It is one of the most serious issues facing the church and its members. Daily scandals, media stories continue to highlight this. All of us are involved, whether we like it or not. And we haven't seen the last of such scandals because we live in a fallen world. But let that not be an excuse. Aim to live lives and run businesses that honor our Lord and the value He has given us in His Word, the Bible. And it leads me on to the seventh critical success factor, learnt again from the Christmas cracker experience. And this is H for harnessing. Harnessing all the skills and resources. 3 weeks ago, I was asked at my local church to preach on the... There are four messages towards the Christmas service, and I was asked to open up the series with the first message. You know, spiritual millionaires, billionaires, trillionaires... Every gift of the kingdom is available at your disposal and my disposal. But do we believe it? Do we exercise faith that draws from such skills? You know, I really believe we need to be challenged more to draw from that bank, that unlimited spiritual bank of our Lord and Savior, of our God, that is available to us. And, you know, so many obvious things are available. Networks. Everyone has a network. I had a group of refugees. A bank in London organized a meeting. This isn't in my notes, and it just comes to me because I think it's so relevant. I asked this group of refugees in this main board in the city of London, how many of you, before you came to England, had any connections or contacts here? Almost all the hands went up. I said, you got your networks. I said, back home, how many have you left who have contacts and connections? All the hands went up. I said, what are you doing now with those networks? Use them. Build on them. Share them. I have a friend who lives in the Canary Islands. He's like me from a Hindu background, accepted Christ. I won't have time to tell you a story, but I tell you one thing the gospel has done in his life since he accepted Christ. Now when he goes out selling goods to the seven islands in the Canary Islands, along with all his samples and book price lists and everything else, he has Bibles and tracts. And every time he's meeting people as part of his business, he sees business as mission, as taking that with him, and as opportunities arise, sharing, giving them tracks, and giving them what they need. There you have it, the seven factors, which spell the letter scratch. And why do I use that word scratch? You see, it reminds me of a friend, my friend Raju Abraham. He called it the mosquito effect. When a mosquito bites you, your response is to scratch where it itches. We live in a world that is itching. Itching to hear the good news of Jesus. Itching to receive news which can transform it. A BAM response may just scratch the surface, but it sure will relieve the itch. Think about it. You know governments alone cannot address this global challenge of issues. Issues like AIDS, the rich-poor divide, fair trading, climate change. There's a huge list that faces governments. I can tell you one thing with absolute confidence. Any solution, any response must include business as a partner. You will see that in the responses from governments now. Business is always brought in as a partner. So the opportunity for business as missions is absolutely clear. If we ignore it, we are being irresponsible. You know, what we sow into today will have a longer lasting legacy beyond anything we may see achieved in our lifetime. I've talked about my friend Dr. Raju Abraham, and you know, the hospitals that he's now working with, medical business units across North India, they didn't just appear overnight. It has been the investment of over 200 years of missionaries who've gone out from the United States, from Britain, from Europe, to go out and serve in what has been described as the missions graveyard. These folk never saw any spiritual dividend. You can apparently see the graveyards of these folk in North India. In one particular case I want to share with you, the laymans. I believe there may be a connection with the laymans of the bank in the United States with this particular layman family. Their son-in-law works with us at our mission in London. And he said, the laymans gave their entire life to a village which is called Herbertpur. And they never saw one person come to Christ in all their life. And finally they retired in South London. They were suffering from Alzheimer's. Behind the river where that hospital was run, scores were beginning to get baptized. And we tried excitedly to tell this elderly couple with Alzheimer's sitting there, and we just didn't know whether they were taking it in or not. We said, hey, this is exciting. Your whole life you've given. Scores are coming to Christ. They're giving their life. And we know they went on to be with the Lord and have from heaven been rejoicing, seeing these lives being baptized. And you know, scores are coming to Christ. I want to show you a short clip before I close. This short clip will show you what's happening in North India. And there is a purpose that I want to show this to you. I literally only gave it to the organizers before the conference. I happened to have it in my bag, and they managed to pick out about 30 seconds of a clip, which should come up any time now. But while that's coming up, this is called Yesu Darbar, and you see this man there, Pastor R.B. Lal. You know, today, now every Sunday, 50,000 people gather together at the Allahabad Agricultural Institute in North India, in Allahabad, to praise and worship Jesus at a place called the Yesu Darbar, the court of the King Jesus. 50,000. If somebody had told me 5 years ago that even 100 or 200 would be meeting, I would say, go and get your brains examined. It's not going to be possible. You're talking of the heartland of the 1040 window. It's happening, folks. But it didn't just happen overnight. It took investment. It took sacrifice. It took service. You know, when we go into business as mission, we may not see the dividends in our lifetime. We may not see the dividends in our lifetime. Is that a reason not to do it? Brothers and sisters, I urge you to think about this exciting challenge. This BAM movement is a nascent emerging movement that has been formally recognized. It is exciting to see so many of you here participating in this historic first in our banner. The question is, will you take the next step and pledge to be part of this history? Asking you a question. I'm asking it again. Will you take the next step and pledge to be part of this history?
Yes.
Amen. And I'm going to make it even louder, third time, and think and pray. Will you take that step and pledge to be part of this history?
Yes.
Amen. You know, my son-in-law Jonah shared with me a quote from the missiologist David Bosch. And I will close with this quote. Mission is a going elsewhere. It may not be a geographic elsewhere. It may be a cultural elsewhere. A going to speaking with a different accent and have a different background. And the first crucial step is out of one's own shoes and into the shoes of another person. That's David Bosch. Message is clear because you and I can make a difference. You know, a story I always share, and if you've heard it before, forgive me, but maybe the Lord wants to hear you to hear it a second, third, fourth, fifth time. I never get tired of the story. It's from a book called The Star Thrower by Lawrence Isley. Little boy by the beach. The tide comes in. The starfish are coming in. And this little boy is throwing the starfish back into the sea. And this old man passes by and sort of laughs. He says, "Hey, young lad, you're wasting your time. What difference are you going to make? Every time you throw some starfish back into the sea, at least 100 more are going to hit the seashore." The little boy picked one up, he said, and he threw it back in. He said, "It's going to make all the difference to that one." Friends, you can make that difference. You can be that difference. That old man went back to write his book. He couldn't even write one more word. He went back to the beach, and he, with his young boy, started throwing the starfish back into the sea. And you have to also think seriously about what you are going to do with this whole BAM initiative. Thank you.